Renowned travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux explores the depths of family relationships with his new novel, Motherland, a darkly hilarious novel of a family held together and torn apart by its narcissistic matriarch. To those in her Cape Cod town, Mother is an exemplar of piety, frugality, and hard work. To her husband and seven children, she is the selfish, petty tyrant of Motherland. Motherland is a portrait of how a parent's narcissism impacts a family. Again, the title of the book is Motherland, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Paul Theroux to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be back with you in the roundtable.
Thank you very much. So, what led you to this particular subject of going to the Motherland?
The key, the germ, is I grew up in a very, very big family, a family not unlike the one in the book. And about 10 years ago, I was wondering, at my age, I was in my early 60s then, I thought, it was more like 12 years ago, I thought, should I write an autobiography? Because that's when people start contemplating, as they get to their 60s up to 70. And I thought, instead of writing an autobiography, I think I'll write a novel based on, more or less, how I grew up, what happened to me, and, you know, the key things. In the same way that Dickens wrote David Copperfield, he was going to write an autobiography, then he changed his mind. So that led me to Motherland. It's not my family, but it's sort of based on. And I had never really written about a big family before. I had written about a family in the Mosquito Coast. It's even a kind of dysfunctional family, too. They come to a bad end in Honduras. That was the germ of it.
This is a family that is, yes, somewhat at war with itself, but with many compensations.
As there is in all big families. I mean, for one thing, a big family is kind of dated. It's rare to find a very big family. There are some, but in general, families these days tend to be small. When I was growing up, I knew a lot of families that had 6, 7, 8. I knew a family that had 12 children. You find that, but it's much rarer now. And I thought, to write about a very big family is looking to the past. The compensations, of course, the biggest compensation in a big family is that you learn how to negotiate. No one in a big family takes the last cookie in the jar. They would say, are you sure you don't want it? Do you want it? People say, no. Do you want it? Are you sure you don't want it? Because if you take the last cookie, you'll make an enemy. You'll probably make 6 enemies. And so negotiation is the biggest compensation in a big family. Learning, and also a big family has its own language, its own customs, its own rituals, and is usually dominated often by one parent or the other, sometimes both. In this family, the mother is the key figure.
And I assume that is where the title comes from, one of its many meanings.
Yes. I hadn't realized that this was going to be published on Mother's Day. So this is the ultimate mother book. I mean, it's a big book. It's the longest novel that I've published. Yeah, in this case, the mother takes charge. The father in the family dies. When the father dies, and this is another mechanism of big family, too, the surviving parent wonders whether he or she is the key figure. You know, where are your loyalties? Are your loyalties with the parent who passed away or with me, the matriarch or the patriarch of the family? And so that's a big factor, too. Who's in charge?
So in this novel, we see the death of the patriarch, and then the mother becomes the key figure, solitary, but really reigns supreme over pretty much everything.
There are a lot of, I mean, probably if you did a course called Family Studies, or I don't know what, a Family Dynamics, there'd be names for all the ways in which she dominates. But you find them, actually, in, you know, if you read about Joseph Stalin or Chairman Mao or Pol Pot in Cambodia, or, I don't know, Kim Jong-un, you find that there's certain ways that dictators gain power. And although this is just a mother and a family, money figures, secrets figures, gossip figures, playing one against the other, there's kind of character assassinations, there's dishonest complaining, you know, there's all these ways of manipulating the family. And the mother is very clever at all of them. It's dark, but it's also, I hope it's comic. I mean, I hope that it has strong comic elements in it. But that's what it is. I mean, it's power plays, I guess you could say, played for laughs in some cases.
Well, in reading the novel, while I think most situations may not be as severe, we all can relate to a family dynamic.
Yeah, I think it's only when, you know, in the one parent family, or so, a parent raising one child, or the single child, I mean, the only child, is in a very unusual position. I used to really feel sorry for friends of mine who were the only child, because I thought there's so much pressure on them, pressure to succeed, pressure to do things, and also with the parents breathing down their neck, you know, driving them to soccer practice and cheering them on. And, you know, no one ever cheered me on. There were too many kids. I really had no pressure. I remember when I joined the Peace Corps, I told my parents that I was going to be in Africa for the next 2 years. And I remember my father saying, oh, that's wonderful. That's great. That's great. You know, great that I did it. Great that I was going to be a teacher in Central Africa in the 1960s. But also, there's one out of the house, you know, one they wouldn't have to worry about. And I can't imagine that that would be the case. You know, if you're an only child, you say, I'm going to be away for 2 years. In my case, it was 6 years, you know, that I was away. And I got married in the meantime and all that. But I can't imagine that, you know, you're an only child. And oh, that was a year, those were the years without cell phones or the internet either. Just, you know, sending a postcard home every so often. But that's the great advantage, actually, of the liberating quality of being on your own and kind of figuring out your destiny and negotiating with your siblings.
The mother is cruel, can be a tyrant, and she wants that loyalty from her kids. She is not especially loyal to those kids, but she wants loyalty. And I guess you have to wonder, and I'm curious as to how you wanted to address this of what her issue is. Like, what is wrong with her that demands that? Did the situation make her that way?
You know, the question that you ask is the key question, is what is behind the mother's need to dominate the family? And I suppose I can only guess at the mother in the book's problem, which is it's her own upbringing. I think that it said that in the childhood of Judas, Jesus was betrayed. So perhaps in the childhood of this woman, there was a trauma or an inadequacy, the way that she was raised, some kind of tension. I can only guess at it. As a novelist, you need to suggest, you can't describe. It's not a textbook, but it obviously is in her past. But it's also the marriage. She is devoted to her husband. The husband's a very moderating influence on the mother in the book, although there's a period where he's in a minstrel show, and when he's in blackface, he becomes a very domineering figure, a dark and dangerous figure. So it's two things. It's her, I suppose it's her childhood. I suggest that in the book. And then it's the death of the father. But you don't spring fully grown as Chairman Mao. You evolve into it. And it's the pressures of the family, the children. It could be the lack of money or the abundance of money. So power evolves. It doesn't appear fully grown. And I think you can see in the book how the mother is transformed into a kind of dragon and then becomes kind of a sweet as she gets older. I mean, the woman in the book lives till almost 104. So in her last 8 to 10 years, she becomes like a little yellow goddess and, you know, with a halo. And she's not doing any harm. She's a survivor. She's lived. And the children realize that as long as she's alive, they will still be her children and be, in a sense, be children themselves. That when she dies, they'll be orphans and they'll be old. So there are all of these tensions, all these qualities kind of make up the mother's domineering aspect.
Paul Theroux is our guest. The name of the new novel is Motherland. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So let's talk about the children, because it does seem that really the only way that they can break free from this is getting the hell out of the house.
But that's true in most families. I think if you want to make something of yourself, you go far, far away. People say, how do you become a writer? Should I go to the Iowa Writers Workshop? Should I go to Stanford? Should I become, you know, the apprentice to a great writer? I say, you know, what you've got to do is leave home. Go away. You don't have to go to a writer's, you know, on a writing program. Read books. Read a lot. And become independent. become what Henry James calls the sort of person on whom nothing is lost. Just everything is got to be interesting to you. But the main thing is to go away so that the people who think they know you will stop asking you questions. What are you going to be? How are you going to publish it? Who like it? Who's going to review it? How are you going to make money? All those questions, which is so annoying. Become a teacher in Central Africa was my answer. And if someone said to me today, well, what do you think I should do? I'd say, join the Peace Corps or join AmeriCorps. Go to Mississippi, teach in a school in the Delta. That's a good way of doing it. So the answer is leaving home. Yeah. But in this family, they don't leave. They have left. They've come and gone. But in the last, let's say, 20 years of the mother's life, the children are there attending to her. So this is kind of how not to live your life happily is when they're all clustered around fighting with each other and then angling for the mother's attention. If they wanted to make something of themselves, they'd leave. It was my answer.
It seems interesting because they go off in the novel, they do their thing, and then they come back. And it's as if, yes, they're checking in on the mother, but they're also checking in on each other to see what's happened to them.
Yeah, very much so, because the mother then starts handing out money, but she hands it out unequally. So in the book, some are getting rich, and others are kind of on the poverty line, and they're wondering, how did this person get a house, and I got a cantaloupe, you know? So, or I got a plate of brownies, and you got 2 acres of land. So it's that, too. That's a big factor in the book, the dispersal of money.
So let us talk about the narrator, J.P., like yourself, a travel writer, and he is our guide through this. And I guess that makes sense because he has that perspective of bringing us through these, for many of the reasons that you just mentioned of people instead of staying home, but traveling and going out in the world.
Yeah, he's a travel writer. He's not me. There's a certain resemblance, but he's certainly not me. I'm speaking to you from Hawaii. I have a very salubrious life here. It's a sunny day. JP in the book is living in a rental on Cape Cod and attending to the mother. He's come to the end of his career rather belatedly. He does fall in love at the end of the book, and there might be wedding bells too. It's kind of suggested, but he's the narrator, and I think that he's a reliable narrator. Except that, one of the features of a big family is that each of the children has a different parent. So the oldest child's view of the mother in this book is very different from the rest of the children. He was an only child. He was born, and then he's the only one there, and the mother adores him. Then as the children come along, they each, the mother reacts to them differently. And JP, in the book, he's number three, he's sort of liberated. The mother's not interested in his writing, and that's another sort of factor. The fact that she's not interested sort of makes him a writer, makes him rebel against her. And that's why he's the narrator. But he says in the book that none of the other children would recognize the exactitude of his portrait of the mother. They would all see her as a slightly different person because they had different experiences with her.
I think it's also fascinating in the relationship between JP and his mother is also the relationship that we see with JP and his own children.
I think his own children are, and then there's one long-lost child. There's the child who, there was a child who was abandoned or given away as an infant, and then he reappears in the book. So there's really three children, three boys in the book. They all seem to be kind of balanced, sensible individuals. They come from, as I said earlier, they come from a small family. He realizes actually how to become a parent by the negative examples that he's had. JP decides that he's not going to make the mistakes that his parents have made. So his children are doing reasonably well, and they're different, and they're very protective of him. They're mature adults. He's the child. They're all kind of behaving like children. And although, as I say, he's a successful writer up to a point, he's still, when he's with his siblings, they're quarrelsome and rancorous and competitive and rivalrous and difficult. The way families are in many cases.
When you look at the family unit and how you have described it, in the novel. And given that what you said at the beginning of starting of looking at wanting to write a perhaps a memoir or an autobiography, did this sort of get that out of your system of looking at a family, even if it wasn't necessarily your family?
I'm very interested in all big families. And when I meet someone, I often talk to people and I say, how many kids in your family? Or, you know, where did you grow up? And what did your father do for a living? And where did you live? And we get to the, and if the person says, oh, yeah, I grew up in a family, there were six of us, there were seven of us, there were eight of us, whatever. I say, sit down. They say, well, it's a long story. And I say, usually, I'm a writer. I love long stories. You know, tell me about your family. Who was the most popular? Who was the funny one? Was any of them gay? I sometimes ask. Because often in a very big family, one of them is a black sheep or is a problem or just goes the other way. You wonder, how did you treat him? Were you sympathetic? Did he come out? Whatever it is. This fascinates me. Traveling as I have in Africa, I mean, I lived in Africa for more than 6 years. I lived in Southeast Asia for 3 years. I lived in England for a long time. I've lived among people, in some cases tribal people, big families, you know, where there was a chief or a king or whatever. And those were families that fascinated me too. So it's given me, it's made me able, I think, to understand or at least to be curious about other big families. The only child family, you know, the single child family is interesting to me, but I don't understand the dynamic. I only understand the pressure that the mm-hmm. only child is under, because people say, oh, so lucky, it must be heaven being an only child. I don't really think that. But it has given me this curiosity about the big family. Generally, the big family exists in South America, in Mexico, in Africa, in India, very much so, not in China, as we know. And then, you know, in Europe, people don't have any children at all. There's a negative growth in Germany and Russia and in Italy. No one wants to have children in those places. And so they're a lot less interesting to me, you know, if we're talking about the no-child family.
Paul Theroux is known for such books as The Lower River, The Mosquito Coast, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, and Deep South. His new novel is Motherland, and he is our guest on the roundtable this morning. When you started traveling extensively, and you mentioned your travels through Africa and spending so much time there, is that when you started to really understand the nature of fiction and the power of fiction is through that travel?
Yes, I often think that I became a writer, one, growing up in a big family, two, going away, and then three, going to really interesting places. That two things were the primary force. One was reading, the other was travel. But also the big family was a factor. Growing up in it and then escaping from it. So a lot of things turn you into a writer. You know, the ability to fantasize, just loving to read, and then liking to write. Writing isn't easy, but it's very satisfying. So I think that also a sense of rebellion. I don't know how old you are, Joe, but can you tell me?
I'm 50.
So you may remember the time, you were kind of on the cusp of it, when a writer like William Styron, Bill Burroughs, mm-hmm. James Jones, Norman Mailer, they were heroes. They were not only heroes, but they were heroic figures, but they were also kind of outlaws. I mean, they were powerful figures. Do you recall that? I mean,
certainly with Mailer.
Mailer, yeah. Mailer was like the last one,
right?
Who was a power figure. And I grew up. They were also, you know, books used to be banned. Books were kind of dangerous things. So you won't remember that because that was the period that ended in the 60s. But
I remember Truman Capote. I remember the impact he had on social impact. I remember Gore Vidal, of course, and Norman Mailer, and the sort of larger than life, and seeing those authors and those literary lions on nightly talk shows, and they had a cultural impact.
Yeah, I mean, they really had a cultural impact, but also the idea of a book, the idea that a book is dangerous, that
yes.
a book should be banned. I mean, now and then people talk about it now, but I mean, the kind of language on television and music and the sort of things that people say, it's just, you know, that was, it was unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable when I was growing up. And I'm even today shocked when I hear certain words on television, because I think, well, if my father was sitting here watching this show, he'd be disgusted. He'd put an axe through that. You know, he would have attacked the television set. But when you think that, say, Tropic of Cancer, which was not able to be bought or read in Boston when I grew up, and I grew up in the 1950s. So in the 1950s, you know, book is dangerous. That can make you a writer. You say, these people are dealing with it like making bombs or making, you know, some kind of artillery. He's making a book. A book is dangerous. A book can hurt you. A book is going to upset people. A book is going to, you know, people in the government are going to, or the church are going to denounce this book. That had a very, very powerful impact on me. And the fact that writers were, well, the ones you mentioned, Mailer, for example, or Burroughs or Henry Miller, they created an image of a power figure. It's not only, maybe now a writer is a kind of a bespectacled person who shows up at your local bookstore and says, can I sign your book? Please buy my book. But that wasn't the case then. These people that we're talking about never showed up in the bookstore. You never saw them. I mean, it wasn't until I went to college that I met a real writer. And that, I remember Ralph Ellison, the author of Invisible Man came to the University of Massachusetts. I was delighted to meet him. I mean, he was a very, very nice man. And it was a time of Malcolm X and Black Power. And he had, you know, his book, although written in the, it came out around 1951, I think, maybe a little earlier. His book had figures like that in it, sort of Black Power figures. And it was about race and about conflict. So he was one of the first writers that I actually met. And I was thrilled because they were people who really didn't show up. They didn't need publicity. They had all the publicity they wanted because their books were vilified. And I thought, you know, it was in my heart. I thought, that's a wonderful image to be. That was a wonderful role to play. I didn't realize how much trouble it was to actually write a book. That came later. You asked whether travel made me a writer. Travel was a very big factor, but travel was gave me something to write about. Generally, if you're home, what do you write about? Soccer game, your mother's upside down cake, you know, skating practice, I don't know, quarrel with someone. Go away and you write about, I lived in a dictatorship. That was a wonderful thing. I mean, I actually saw the mechanism of power enacted. I was only, you know, 22 years old, and I was living in Nyasaland that became Malawi. I had something to write about. And so my first books were about Africa. They were novels set in Africa.
Do you feel you ever achieved that goal of writing a dangerous book, of a book that had that power of the people that you aspired to be?
That's an excellent question. Did I ever do what the people I admired did? I think what I discovered was that with the relaxation of censorship, there was no necessity to outrage people. And so you can say, although, I mean, I must say, four-letter words are very rare in my book. The idea that when I see a TV show and people are swearing all the time, I think, I never write that way. I don't. First, it's useless. Secondly, you know, what's the point? Thirdly, I think I have a sufficient vocabulary, and often people don't really talk that way. So did I ever write the book that outraged a generation? No, I don't think so. But I think that certain things that I've written have been prescient. When I wrote The Mosquito Coast, I wrote it at a time when the country was, you know, it was late 70s, early 80s, when there was a fuel crisis, oil crisis, and big problems with the Arabs, actually, with Arab oil companies, and they were raising their prices. And so that was a book about a man who says, this country is gone. This country isn't the same country that I grew up in. I want to leave. And he leaves. He says, the hell with it. You know, we're going to go to Central America. We're going to start our own place. So that was a book that captured a mood at the time, Mosquito Coast. Powerful book. I mean, I don't know. That's for the reader to judge. The movie was pretty good.
Yes, it was.
With Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And I think that was the kind of book that I had admired. You know, when I was growing up, I loved adventure stories. So that was both an adventure, and I think it had a philosophical and political implications too. It's also funny, I hope. I could look at that as an example of a book that I found very fulfilling, very satisfying, and that had, I think, I hope, power, or the power to move a reader and hold a reader, and so that the reader would sit and say, you know, might during the day think, well, I'm going home to read this book, to read The Mosquito Coast. I hope with Motherland that a person would get, you know, it's a long book, it's more than 500 pages. Some would say, you know, I'm 50 pages into it. I want to go, you know, want to have a drink, Jim? No, I think I'll go home. I got a book. I'm reading a book on my Kindle, or I'm reading a book. It's a great thing to have a book at home on the boil, on the go, one that you're reading, that you're going back to, that you read 10 pages before you go to sleep or on a Sunday morning. I didn't write The Naked and the Dead, but I couldn't. That's Norman Mailer's book. I wrote my own books.
Well, as the youngest of a large Catholic family, it was wonderful to read about a large, rambling Catholic family.
Were you an altar boy?
Of course.
Can you recite the Susipiat? Susipiat Dominum Sacrificium et Debanis Patuus Laudi Gloria Nominis Sui Utilitatum. Can you finish that?
I cannot.
Totiusque Ecclesiae Sui Sancte? That's too bad.
No.
But you probably grew up during
I was post-Latin after the... yes. After...
I'm not putting you on the spot. Yeah, that's right. I'm older than you. I had.
Well, it was Latin. after Vatican II. Yes, it was.
we used to have contests of reciting the Confidia, Confidia Dei Omnipotenti, Beata Maria Semper Virginis. See who could win. You could win. You know, other kids had, I don't know, shooting baskets. I was
sure.
Reciting the Confidia. That's where we grew up in Medford, Massachusetts.
I did a full litany on Sunday. That was something I hadn't done in a long time. So.
Good.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you for sharing with us. And it is it's a delightful novel, and it's beautiful to read. And I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to talk to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Paul Theroux's new novel is Motherland. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.